John, we have a lot of intriguing issues to look at regarding this scenario, but one of the more compelling issues to me is the difference between how a pilot would answer this question sitting around a table and how they would respond to it in a cockpit.
Oh, absolutely. That's the whole point here, is that we could sit here and talk about this, but when you're out there faced with a situation like this and you have literally seconds to respond to it and come up with something, the only way you can really prepare for that is by thinking about it beforehand and practicing. And as you said earlier when we were talking about it, is the engine out on takeoff. You can sit there and talk about it all day, but when it happens and you have only a couple of seconds to react, you only have one possible correct action.
And as human beings, instinctively, our response to your scenario and the engine failure on takeoff are both wrong.
It
is only through discipline and training that we do what we're supposed to do, and the downside of following our instincts is deadly. If you do the wrong thing close to the ground in the weather, quite frankly, you're going to die.
Yeah.
And so that is why, you know, sitting around a table, you know, everyone will say, well, this is what I'm going to do. I'm going to go missed approach. But our instinct as people, as humans, as pilots, focused on accomplishing the approach successfully, landing at the destination we set out to. So how do we get so that we as pilots have enough respect for the right answer versus what our gut is telling us?
Discipline and establishing limits. We talk a lot about personal minimums, but personal minimums can go way beyond 1,000-foot ceiling or 3 miles visibility. Personal minimums could be if we've exceeded 20 degrees of bank while we're in flying the airplane under instrument reference. That's a minimum. We should never exceed that. If we get a nav flag at a certain critical phase of flight, the airspeed is unstabilized. There's minimums or limits for anything, and we need to decide in advance when we've reached that limit, we're going to take this action.
And while you've given a lot of check rides, and you know we always stress the parameters before the check rides. These are the things that will allow you to pass the check ride, and these are the ones that will lead to an unsuccessful outcome. Well, in the case of this situation here, it really is cut and dried. I mean, you stay within these boundaries, you pass. If you step over this line, you will fail. But why, when we end up, you know, on a check ride, everyone's going to do the right thing. But when we're heading to our vacation home in Nantucket, the rules are for somebody else.
Yeah, John used the term personal minimums. That's good. But I call it flying discipline. It's easy, as we've all agreed, sitting here in the chair, that the right action is go around. That's logical thinking here with plenty of time to think about it. We have to remember when we're in the airplane that that's how we came to that conclusion and then execute it. As I mentioned, one of the things that I like to do with people is make a list of all the things that could cause one to make a missed approach on an instrument approach. Most people come up real quickly with no runway at decision height and those two that we know, MDA, can't see anything. But then if you think through it, certainly nav flag inside the final fix is one on my list. There is a whole bunch of others. I can think of 7 or 8 right off the top of my head. And if we have actually gone through that logical process and in the chair decided I'm going around when one of these things happens, then when we have the scenario that John just presented, we've already made that decision. So all we have to do is perform the actions. We don't have to wonder, think about it, if we maintain our discipline.
And how about the difference between being creative and following the rules? Following the rules, you know, you are going to live to fly another day. Creativity, we've all read accident reports where we pilots attempt to be creative and figure, you know, the rules are for somebody else. And those are usually in accident reports rather than in happy stories. Bob, what are your thoughts on that?
Well, being creative while on the approach is not the way to have a successful outcome. The approach has been designed to be performed a certain way. You were trained to perform that approach in a certain fashion. That's the way you should fly the approach. And whenever you feel there's a need to reinvent the approach, that means something's wrong. And when you feel like something's wrong, it probably is wrong. Good time to initiate a go-around, climb to altitude as prescribed on the approach plate, and then when you're in a safe environment, reevaluate the situation and decide what you need to do.
And just putting my FAA hat on for a second here, you know, one thing we saw when sitting on my side of the desk, as I did, is that, you know, the rules, that big, thick binder that we hold with the FARs in it, it's all written in blood. You know, if this was all common sense, we wouldn't have to regulate how to do it. But we've been flying airplanes for over 100 years now. We know what works and we know what doesn't.
And it's not so much, ask any pilot, what's the rules, you know? What's VFR minimums? 1,003, okay? So why do we then try to shave those rules sometimes, okay? It's a 900-foot ceiling. Well, 900 is as good as 1,000, or it's 2.5 miles visibility, or the decision height on this approach is 250 feet. Oh, I can go to 240, or, you know, that's where you start getting into that shaving it a little bit and shaving it a little bit. I need 45 minutes of fuel for reserve. I've got 40 minutes left. Is that close enough? There's a very, very dangerous attitude there where you can really start shaving that stuff.
It's a slippery slope. I mean, it truly is. And there's a reason why we call them minimums, because those are the standards. When you go below them, all bets are off. And who wants to operate in that realm? And so in this case here, you know, you get sucked in a little bit. The localizer, you know, goes in, goes out. Oh, it's probably going to come right back. So we press on. Well, what is hope going to get us?
It's going to get you further down that slippery slope.
Further down the slippery slope. And it's a surprise. I mean, when we're surprised, it brings high stress. And we kind of stop thinking because now we're very distracted. And all of a sudden, we're not ahead of our airplane anymore. We're chasing our airplane. It's still moving forward at 90 knots. And we're stuck back there on the flag that's staring at us.
Back to my point, if you've already done the thinking before you leave on the trip and decided, if I see a flag, I'm making a missed approach, you put a lot of that behind you.
John, this, as I said, this scenario has so many intricacies to it that I just love. And, you know, you describe this pilot in glowing terms. Everything is really good about this day, but along with that comes the complacency issue. Yep. And how many times have we seen a complacent pilot, you know, getting kind of sucked into doing the wrong thing? And once again, this guy is all set up. He knows this airport. He knows the weather. He knows everything. And yet here he is getting ready to do the wrong thing because he is ever so complacent heading into his familiar airport. And how many accident reports have we all read that occurred in the local patch?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Over-familiarity, having done it over and over again. You know, he just has a comfort level that allows him to keep going. But then again, you know, and if you decide to press into the weather, right now you're VFR, what happens between this, okay, I'm in the VFR, nothing dangerous, nothing hazardous other than this red flag versus pressing on and going into the fog? Has your situation changed ever so slightly by delaying?
You've reached a bingo mentality at that point, or you should reach a bingo mentality, that something has happened which forces you to terminate the approach and initiate your miss. You have lost one major component of your ILS. That should be good enough to initiate the missed approach at that point. Even if you don't go to another airport, at least climb away from the ground and reevaluate.
Yep.
You know, let's just take a look at, you know, because we think of an ILS approach. You know, we talked earlier about an ILS approach. Pretty simple. You know, we got a localizer, we got a glide path. And, you know, if those two things are working, we're on the ground. I don't care what the weather is. You know, that'll get us in there. But, you know, if you really step back and look at an ILS approach, it's a complex system with many components, all of which are subject to mechanical or human failure, which kind of leads us into how prepared are we mentally and physically to fly a missed approach go around. You know, we've talked about that before. Are you ready to go around or are you ready to land? And if you're not ready for the go around, you know, we're behind our airplane and setting ourselves up for failure. And then you start throwing into that, oh, not only am I going around, what am I going to do?
And come up with a plan on the fly because you hadn't thought about it beforehand. And pre-flight planning, touch a little bit on alternate selection. Every instrument pilot can recite all the criteria for coming up with an alternate, the 1-2-3 rule, 600 and 800 and everything. But how many times do you really think about what might make you, first of all, need an alternate, And then what criteria would be required for the alternate? Commercial operators are required to go through an even much more extensive planning procedure. Bob, you know, as a 135 operator, all the stuff that's required just in alternate selection.
Yes, very, very detailed requirements in terms of analyzing the prospective alternate. But that should also be done as a Part 91 pilot. There is a selection process which should be followed. You need to study your government plates and recognize that for many airports and many approaches, use as an alternate is not authorized. And for another subset of many airports and many approaches, there are non-standard alternate minimums which are applicable. In other words, the 602 for precision approaches and the 802 for non-precision approaches may not necessarily apply, even though the airport and approach could be used as an alternate. The requirement may be more stringent. It may be 702 for an ILS approach, as an example, rather than 602. Or the approach, airport and approach, may only be usable as an alternate if the control tower is manned. There may be other requirements. You'll find this information on non-standard alternates in the front sections of the government plates.
One of the things that I think we need to look at here, too, is the subject of realistic training. How many pilots go out on a regular basis and are challenged to deal with a surprise or a rapid change in conditions? You know, your pilot here, he's done this a lot, but there's been a flow to it and it works. Mm-hmm. But one of the things that I used to like to do on a check ride was throw in a surprise, you know, bring the person to a point of quick stress when things are going well, just to see how they respond as human beings to surprises, to changes. How do you create those kind of scenarios? While in your training, how do you get pilots to look at this aspect that they don't often do on their own?
Well, I've tried to learn to be pretty tricky about inducing nav failure flags during the approach, and depending on the equipment in the airplane, sometimes I get caught and sometimes I don't. But certainly, certainly introducing nav failure on approaches should be part of the training. No question about that. Another thing I do sometimes is I'll issue a missed approach just inside the final fix. I'll say the tower has just said the runway's closed, you need to go around. And that's to see, how the pilot handles that, whether they actually fly to the missed approach point before they begin their turn and how they do it. So there's a couple of examples that I think goes beyond just to go down to decision height and either land or make a missed approach.
Touch on that missed approach procedure, too. And during the scenario, we talked about the difficulty in locating the missed approach point and using a kind of a generic avionics setup in this. Depending upon the kind of navigator you have, you may or may not be able to determine when you're on the final approach course, and depending upon when you get to the missed approach point. In this case, we could probably use our Garmin to identify ourselves over the airport, but we may not have that luxury in whatever airplane we're flying. And I just want to emphasize again the importance of knowing where you are and not starting that turn too early.
In this scenario, that pilot may be required to dead reckon to the missed approach point, because a missed approach is surveyed to start at the airport or within 1.5 nautical miles beyond the airport. So if your missed approach requires a turn, that approach has been surveyed to allow for that turn at the airport or slightly beyond. If you initiate the turn 3 miles prior to reaching the airport, there's no reason that you could be assured that you have terrain clearance for that turn at that point. So I think that's a point that everyone should understand.
Yeah, the TURPS criteria is pretty specific on that. But the point is that you want to climb first, get altitude, and then decide when you want to start the turn. And the turn has to wait until the missed approach point.
Yes.
I think, once again, this scenario points out the subtle pressures that, when applied in a manner such as this, easy flight, easy airplane, plenty of proficiency, plenty of all this, but one subtle breakdown over which we had no control, the nav aid goes out, the whole situation does a 180 on us.